Hi, this is Clint.
And this is Lizzie.
Today, we interview Jill Rowley, sales evangelist, speaker, podcast host, and all-around super cool person.
Yeah, Jill is our first social influencer guest with over 300,000 followers on LinkedIn.
And that certainly came across loud and clear in today's interview. Jill is pure energy. I loved her stories about driving change at MarTech companies over the past 20 years. Yeah.
And Jill has such a refreshing approach to selling. She's all about putting the customer at the center of everything she does as a seller and creating value for customers through partnerships.
And she's taken that idea one step further with her new company, Nearbound, and the idea of partner tech for customer success. Yep.
I also really appreciated her comments on the power of women in sales. And that segment certainly hit home for you, Clint, didn't it? You opened up more personally today than I think I've ever heard from you before.
Yeah, so very true. All right, folks, enjoy today's pod. Joining us today is Jill Rowley, a trailblazer in social selling and digital sales transformation, renowned for her dynamic approach to reshaping the role of sales in companies around the world. With an impressive sales track record spanning over 20 years, including pivotal roles at Oracle and now as a sales consultant, she's a powerhouse of innovative sales strategies. Her philosophy, centered on the give-to-give principle, emphasizes the power of meaningful connections and community building in the digital age. As a much-sought-after speaker and advisor for top B2B companies, Jill's influence extends far beyond the boardroom, inspiring a new generation of sales professionals to thrive in an ever-evolving marketplace. Welcome, Jill.
Thanks, Clint and Lizzie. I'm excited to be here.
We're happy to have you, Jill. I love the powerhouse comment, by the way, Clint. So, Jill, I know you're higher on energy in all the best ways. Got a question for you as what we'll call our icebreaker before we start hopping into the meat of our conversation today. Can you share with us what your not-so-guilty or maybe guilty pleasures are during what we'll call downtime, if that even exists for you in your world?
Yes, actually more downtime these days than when I was in my extreme workaholism mode, living in the Bay Area and just access to unlimited opportunities for meetings and coffees and lunches and dinners and networking events and conferences. I live in Charleston, South Carolina now, and I love Orange Theory. If you haven't done Orange Theory and you want to know about it, I am happy to connect offline. It is a HIIT workout with cardio and the weight room. And as we get older, it's important to not just run on the treadmill, but to lift weights and strengthen our core and everything else in our bodies.
Well, now I know what I'm Googling right after this interview. Orange Theory, huh?
Orange Theory.
Nice.
Okay. And Clint, I actually know what Orange Theory is, and I'm laughing because I would not have ever considered that downtime, but I just find that very amusing. And it's not something, admittedly, I've ever looked into or had an interest in.
I think that tells us a lot about Jill right there, doesn't
it? It's my me time. It's 1 hour that I don't have a cell phone. It is, I leave it in the locker or in my bike basket because I'll ride my bike to Orange Theory. It is me time.
Well, me time is probably the most important part of that. Well, Jill, let's learn even more about you. Tell us the Jill Rowley origin story. How did you get started in your sales career and what took you to your latest company, Nearbound?
So I graduated college in 94, UVA undergraduate business school program. I actually spent 6 years in consulting after college. I didn't know what software was. I didn't know what the tech industry looked like. It wasn't until I made my way out to the Bay Area that I stumbled upon a company called Salesforce. And back then it was Salesforce.com. And that was in 2000, the year 2000. And I ended up being one of the first 100 employees at Salesforce. That's how I got my start in software sales. HR, actually, the question in the interview was, you don't have any quota carrying experience. That's a concern of ours. And I said, you knew that when you brought me in. And based on the conversation that we've had today, what else do you need to know that I can do the job? So Yeah, it was. I saw,
look at you knocking down objections right out of the gates. Love
I
it.
Had Googled objection handling. I had actually Googled like sales terminology so that like buying sign, I had Googled all of these things so that I could go in to the interview with some language around pipeline and forecasting and all the things that I then learned in the profession of sales.
And what came next after that? Because I know you've done a variety of different roles, and there's a couple cool stories that I want to start navigating towards in there.
Sure. So I joined Eloqua in 2002 as employee number 13. And in 2002, there were maybe a handful of MarTech companies. Keto didn't exist. HubSpot didn't exist.
Well, I was actually at Epiphany at that time working with Phil Fernandez and John Miller, who then went on to start Marketo. So you're right, Marketo hadn't started because we were all over at Epiphany. Then you joined Eloqua, which really defined the marketing automation industry.
Exactly. Demand generation wasn't a function when I joined Eloqua because it was still very much brand marketing and very much analog. The web, www.whatever.com, was actually quite new. And websites were corporate brochures. They didn't have sign up for our newsletter. They didn't have download our ebook. There were no landing pages. There were no forms. So yeah, I helped create the category of marketing automation. I spent 10 years at Eloqua. And very few people really understand that I was an individual quota carrying sales rep for all of those 10 years. Inadvertently, I built a personal brand as an evangelist for MarTech, marketing automation, digital marketing transformation, the modern marketer, revenue marketing, and also coined part of the early group that coined the term social selling, and ultimately ended up doing professional speaking on what is social selling and what is digital sales transformation. Was on the NASDAQ when Eloqua went public in 2012. And then 4 months later, we were acquired by Oracle for just under $1 billion.
And then that takes us forward through several years of you being an evangelist, a public speaker, and now you're involved with a new software company called Nearbound. Tell us a little bit about Nearbound.
Yeah. Quickly in between, I went to Marketo, which I think is important because in the year leading up to the acquisition by Adobe, the CEO, Steve Lucas, at the time recruited me. He recruited me because of my market knowledge and influence.
That must have been a little tough because you went from Eloqua, now Oracle, to Marketo. And those two companies were fierce enemies, right? They were number one competitors against each other. And so you went over to the competitor and that must have, I don't know, how did that feel?
It felt right because it was 2012 when Eloqua was acquired by Oracle, and it was December 2017 when I joined Marketo. And what we had built at Eloqua was no longer. And the more time that it was owned by Oracle, the less it looked like the Eloqua that we had built. And so for me, it's always been about what is right for the customer, what is right for the market, and what is right today. And I knew that Marketo was more of what was right.
We definitely want to hit on that too. The fact that, well, what I'm hearing too, the theme of change, and you sound like a change enabler is what we refer to them as, Jill, internally here at Sugar, is you went on from your Oracle and Marketo, and now you're with Nearbound. Do you want to start on that? And then we can shift to the changes that you've seen and how things have evolved.
Yeah. So great. I'll distinguish between Nearbound is a new category. And I've been part of category creation, right? Marketing automation, actually Salesforce automation when I was at Salesforce, the delivery of a subscription model. That was category creating. Marketing automation, MarTech more holistically, social selling, category creation. Nearbound is category creation. It is more of the philosophy. It is the vision of outbound, interruptive, prospecting, stealing someone's time, inbound, attracting and pulling people in through content and other things of value. Nearbound is a surround strategy. Mm. It's a surround. So outbound, inbound, nearbound, surround. And the idea is you're going to be surprised who's at the center. The customer is at the center of a nearbound strategy. And what you say is who surrounds the customer.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get closest to the customer. She who is closest to the customer wins. She who stays closest to the customer continues to win. So you ask yourself, who surrounds the customer today? Who does the customer already work with? Who do they trust? Who do they buy from? And these could be partners, right? But complementary software providers that integrate with Sugar. It could be service providers, right? Agencies, SIs, who actually configure software, help companies set strategy around digital transformation, supply chain optimization. And so you say in communities, where does this customer learn? Who do they trust? Where are they influenced in various communities that they might be a member of? And my strategy will then be, I want to get nearer to those who are nearest to the customer. And I want to learn, I want to leverage intel, I want to earn influence and get intros to the customer that I want to have from the people who already work and influence the customer. Nearbound is the vision, it's a strategy, it's a category. And there are software companies that actually help companies operationalize Nearbound. And the software, the B2B software, is all about partnerships, partner ecosystems. And the core of the software is account mapping. It is the ability to second-party partner data. It is the ability to compare simply customer lists. So how many mutual joint customers does Sugar have with MediaFly? So Sugar and MediaFly could be great partners and probably are great partners. What is the overlap? What is the overlap in customers? When you look at the overlap in customers, you say, what is the joint value proposition? Why are customers more successful when they use Sugar with MediaFly integrated? Okay. Now you say Sugar has customers that are in MediaFly's ICP. Actually, MediaFly has open opportunities at these companies that are already Sugar customers. How do you share intel and influence and make intros so that you can win more joint customers? The same is true that MediaFly has customers that could be Sugar customers. It's this ability to actually have a shared, safe CRM where historically that's been done via spreadsheets. And a spreadsheet is outdated the minute you give it to a rep at the other company or the partner manager at the other company. So there's this whole new category of what I'm calling partner tech, where because partner ecosystem is becoming a more dominant business model, a more dominant way to go to market, you have to have a tech stack to support this new go-to-market motion. Is that helpful?
You know, it's super helpful. It's very inspiring. And I love that you are a category creator, Jill. Thanks for describing all of that. You're answering some of the questions that I wanted to talk with you about today, which is around the evolution of selling techniques. You're hitting on the social selling, the digital transformation, and now this new nearbound surround approach. Can you talk through, as you're engaging with sellers, the people that are prospecting, they're on the front lines, responsible for bringing in these new deals, new customers, they should know that customer. Can you talk to us about how you go in and educate? Or I think you had the term, was it edu? Did I hear you say edutain earlier?
Yes.
When we were chatting? Can you talk more about that?
I'm an edutainer, not a trainer. So I am more of the why, right? Like I give people the aha or the oh shit moment, right? The aha is like, oh gosh, now that makes a lot of sense. There's language around it. I needed language. I needed definitions. For example, like social selling. My definition was using social networks, not social media. Like salespeople, it's about a network. Salespeople, it's about relationships. Marketing, it's about social media and it's about reach, right? More of this broad reach. So my definition of social selling was teaching sales professionals how to leverage social networks that their buyers were using, LinkedIn, to do research on the buyer, the buying committee, the smarty pants people who influence the buyer. So it's first to do research, to be relevant, to build relationships that drive revenue, but beyond revenue, customer lifetime value and advocacy. And so it's really a just another channel, just like podcast. Now, if I want to learn about someone, I'll go and search Google, put someone's name in and put podcast, and then it'll give me what podcast this person has been on. And there's nothing better than going and listening to a podcast, hearing the words that the person you're trying to earn their attention and build trust with. There's nothing better than going to a podcast and listening. It is just a way to drive deeper connections, to understand what motivates someone, right? And so this modern selling, it isn't modern. It's the modern way to uncover information about the buyer, the customer, the people who educate and inform the buyer that you want to have.
Do you think that sellers need to have an inherent curiosity to do what you're describing, go out and research? Or do you find that that's a trainable, knowing that you don't train, but somebody else may, do you find that that's a trainable quality, something that you can train someone on?
I think it is more innate in the way someone's wired. That doesn't mean that someone can't learn to be more curious, much like creativity, right? So much like creativity, you can learn how to be more creative, much like writing. I'm not a writer, but I can learn to do better writing than I do today. I'll never be a journalist. I'll never do content marketing. I'm less of a creator of content than I am a curator of content. I used to call myself the information concierge for buyers. I was the information concierge. I was the content connoisseur because the information wasn't as widely available for the buyer as it is today. Today, it's not about information. It's about insights. So you can have all of this information. The buyer has all this information. But what can I bring to the buyer that actually is an insight that connects this information that's available to what the buyer, put it in the context. Curiosity, context. Context is one of the most important things as a professional seller. You have to be able to put things into the context of the customer.
Just for the sake of time, Jill, I want to actually switch topics. So in sales and also leadership and all of the companies that you've been with over the last several years, especially being employee one of 10 or 100, give or take, depending on the company. Can we talk about the role of women in sales and how you've seen that change, if at all? Where does it stand today compared to the past?
I've been asked the question many times, being a woman in sales, especially in software, that must have been hard, being one of the only women in the room. For me personally, I've actually looked at it as an advantage. In the sense of, for me, I would rather stand out than blend in. And so I was prepping last week for a session I'm doing for ZoomInfo's Women in Sales organization. And I realized that for me, the curiosity and the confidence and the conviction that I have is more uncommon than common. And in doing research and being part of many now different women's organizations, the data is what motivates me to actually be part of the conversation about how do we change the opportunity for women the data shows that in the frontline salesperson, that it is actually 50-50, men and women. The data shows that women in sales perform. They have higher win rates. They have higher quota attainment, and they're more relevant and empathetic with their buyers. When you look at the women in sales, quote, leadership, VP and above, the numbers are very different. There are 24% of VP and above sales is women and 76% men. And every layer you go up in the hierarchy, there are fewer and fewer and fewer women in those positions. Same with venture capital. It is really lopsided. The number of women in investing roles in venture capital and also in the funding of female-founded companies, it's very lopsided. And so what we need is we need more women lifting women, more community and resources for women to be more successful in being able to earn going up in the ranks of an organization. We also need more men who are willing to sponsor, support, mentor, coach women. And I look at men who have daughters and I say, don't you want your daughter to have the same opportunity that your son has?
It's such an amazing mental block that we operate in as a society as a whole. Because, you know, my experience of success in the sales ranks of women versus men are exactly what you've described, right? Over and over again, the top performers that I've worked with in my career are female. But when you get to that sales leadership ranks, I just don't even understand why it changes the way you just described. And certainly agree with your comments that we need to take a proactive stance on changing it. Have you seen, what have you seen most successful in your career in terms of changing that dynamic? Do you have like anything you could point to specifically that here I saw it work really well differently? Or is it just culture starts at the top and leaders need to change the way they think and we need to have more female leaders and just it starts there?
It's really a whole host of things. Much like anything, it's never one thing, right? Yeah. There's not the one thing that I could do to build more pipeline today. It is more of the mix of things that are necessary. It actually starts at the earliest development of boys and girls and the things that we teach little girls versus the things that we teach little boys.
The language at the early stage. I agree.
Manners versus how to win, right? Little girls learn about please and thank you and being courteous and kind. And boys learn about how to be brave and get in the game.
You know, the one I'm a father of both young man, young women, and I hate the blue versus pink thing. That drives me crazy. My daughter, Juliet, never liked pink, ever had any interest in pink. And once it became evident to her that she was being stigmatized or put into a certain definition if she wore pink, she just hated pink from that point forward, never wore it. To me, that's it. There's one thing that we could all change as parents out there is just to get rid of that blue pink thing. Why can't I like pink as a guy? Why can't you like blue as a girl? Frankly, why are we caring about colors?
No, Clay, it's getting worse. If you go on TikTok or Instagram and you search gender reveal parties, it's obnoxious the extent that people are going to on these gender reveal parties. They're spending thousands and thousands of dollars to, you know, have a plane fly over.
I don't even understand why that's important. I have a true mental block and I do not get...
Same.
Yeah. 10 fingers, 10 toes. That's all I care about.
Wouldn't it be health that matters? It should be. Are they healthy? Look, and I watched a documentary, National Geographic did it with Katie Couric, and it was on essentially transgender. And we do these gender reveals. And who has a kid and thinks they're going to be gay? And so I had dinner the other night with a couple from California and very conservative, wealthy background. country club. And the woman shared with us, her son is gay. And I like wanted to clap. Like, that's amazing. One of my best friends in Charleston that I work out with at Orange Theory is gay.
Yeah, I got to tell you, one of the proudest moments of my entire life was when my daughter came to me and said, Dad, I'm gay. And I did the worst answer, which was, I know. Right. And that is truly a horrible answer, because right answer is, I'm so proud of you for telling me, because it's such a hard thing for her to say to me. And I kind of looked at her and said, yeah, I know. And she looked at me almost a little deflated, because there's this moment that she had built towards, and I brushed past it because I did know, right? As a parent, we know our kids. Yeah. It's a crazy world that we live in at times. It's time to change it, but I'm going to pull us back towards our conversation here a little bit. I love where we went. In fact, I want to do a whole podcast on that very topic.
If we summarize that, I think, Jill, what I'm hearing from you is it starts with confidence. And that confidence starts with probably parents or your environment. And then at some point, as you enter the workforce, you need support. You need people there to give you opportunity and trust and believe in you.
Absolutely. See it, be it as well. So if you can see it, then you can be it. And I wrote an article on LinkedIn, I don't know, 2014, 15. It's still there. And it was titled, to be provocative, why women can't be leaders. And it was, we can, but we don't see enough of it. And when we start to, and I talked about women who were my mentors who didn't know I existed. And it was women that I, you know, Beth Comstock was an example. I ended up meeting Beth Comstock and working with her when she was at GE. She wrote a book and it's on my shelf. But one of the beauties of the web and YouTube and podcast and social media is that we can see more of who we want to be. And so you might not have someone officially mentor you, but you can absolutely learn from that person.
Question for you, but it's a really, really fun discussion here. But let's bring it back to an interview for a second here and ask you, how have you changed over the years? We've talked about so much about how the industry is changing and how sellers need to change the way they approach, but if you look back on your career as a salesperson, as a information concierge, if you will, look back to that beginning 20 years ago and look to where you are today. Tell me about that growth, that evolution of Jill Rowley.
I would say that I got real clear on my purpose as I matured and had more experience and more wins, individual wins, right? In sales, oftentimes, you're the rep of the quarter, you're the rep of the year, you're president's club. I loved those trophies. I have a bunch of them. What I really felt the shift was, my purpose is more broadly to enrich other people's careers and elevate the marketing profession, elevate the sales profession, elevate the partner profession. And not just the profession, like sales profession, like let's change the image of when a salesperson, when you hear about someone who's a sales professional, you think of them as a professional because they are doing things that are professional. They're not tricks. They're not. But there's this shift of impact at scale for me. I really dream in scale and I want to have impact at scale. That can be made through many individuals. And I'm attracted to people who are learn-it-alls. I'm attracted to people who have a growth mindset. I say I'm a talent spotter. And I want to instill the confidence and the courage, the commitment and conviction that I have into others. And the shift really...
Well, maybe that's the next step in your career is Professor Rowley. Yeah, how about that one? I like that one. Teaching people
the
best sellers, right? And selling is, as you said, it's about unlocking the world of possibilities for somebody who's looking to buy. That's fantastic. I love it.
Thank you, Professor Rowley.
I was just going to say, let's stick with that. So Professor Rowley, I have one last question for you. Where can our listeners find you and learn more about you, whether that be, we always say LinkedIn, blogs, websites, anything that you would put out
there. ChatGPT. I've ChatGPT'd myself, right? Of course, I Googled myself. What? ChatGPT Jill Rowley and prompt it in B2B SaaS, what is Jill Rowley known for? What has she accomplished in her career? Go to ChatGPT. It's the first time I've said that on a podcast.
Love it. Yeah, I haven't heard that one before. We typically hear the LinkedIn response, right, but you just gave us the new one, ChatGPT response. But you do have over 315,000 followers on LinkedIn, so we might be able to find you there too, right?
Yes, but don't send me a generic invite to connect.
I saw that on your profile.
But you would be, if I opened up my invites in my LinkedIn, there are like 330 and none of them are personalized because I don't want to accept generic invites anymore.
I appreciate that. You're setting standards.
I love it. Don't be generic. That's good advice.
Yeah.
All right, Jill. Well, it was a pleasure having a nice chat with you today.
Jill, thank you for meeting us today. Yeah, this was great. Thank you so much for allowing me to share my wisdom and my passion.